Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, I think we're recording. So we should just tell everyone listening that it's not Reza Aslan's fault that the lawnmowers and blowers are outside. They will be done momentarily, we hope.
Actually, those guys just follow me around.
Oh, they do? Everywhere yeah. You go?
It's wherever I go.
Yeah, there's a blower behind you and a
like
lawnmower?
Three guys with a blower just blowing
Can
leaves.
Can you imagine that? So let's just tell people who you are and how you got here.
Yeah.
So actually, you know what? The first time I ever saw you was, I'm sure the way a lot of people saw you was on Fox News.
Oh yeah, 2011.
2011. Tell us that segment real quick in 140, 280 characters.
In 280 characters. This the segment that will like essentially one day be stamped on my gravestone. Yeah, this was, you know, I wrote this book about the historical Jesus because that's kind of what I do, and it was my first time on Fox, believe it or not. I'd been booked on Fox before, but the interview had never happened.
So you'd like been booked and you show up and they're like, yeah, we got to put Sean Hannity on or something like
that. Worse, way worse than that. They do pre-interviews, right? So
yeah,
they
yeah,
call
yeah,
you
yeah,
the pre-interviews. Yeah. And I've done pre-interviews with, you know, almost every, you know, news network.
This is actually a pre-interview.
This is a pre-interview.
Sorry to tell you.
Eventually we'll push record.
Yeah.
And this was for the O'Reilly Factor. All right, this is a great story. So they called me and they're like, okay, so, you know, we'd like you to come on the O'Reilly Factor and we'd like you to talk about, you know, the issue of religion and violence and particularly Islamic terrorism. And I was like, okay. And then they said, then the pre-interviewer guy said, okay, so would you say that the problem is with the Quran? And I said, well, no. I mean, look, scripture is scripture. It all depends on interpretation. You know, there's plenty of stuff in the Quran that promotes peace and plenty of stuff that promotes violence. And it's up to the individual, you know, which ones they follow and which ones they don't, just like it is with, you know, anybody else in any other religion. And he said, right. Good. Okay. All right. So, but what about the Quran? Would you say that the real problem, though, is, you know, with the Quran? And I was like, oh, maybe he just didn't hear me. So I repeated myself and I was like, okay, this is, you know, scripture without interpretation is just words on a page. It takes someone to actually confront it in order to give it any kind of meaning, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, right, okay. So let me ask you this. If I were to ask you, is the problem with the Quran, what would you say? I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, look. Okay, one more time. I'm just going to say this one more time. And I said the exact same thing, and he said, all right, great. Well, thank you very much. And the car was supposed to come and pick me up at like 4 o'clock, and I'm sitting there.
And it never shows up.
And the car never showed.
That's amazing.
Literally, the car just didn't show.
It's so funny because people think that, you know, when they see an expert, quote unquote, on TV, or they read an expert quote in an article, that there's been a tremendous amount of time that's gone into that. And more often than not, even in places, reputable places like the New York Times, Washington
yeah.
Post, it's the first person who picked up the phone.
First person who gave you a quote.
First person who gave you the quote. But on like Fox News or CNN or MSNBC, it's the person that fits the narrative for the story so the producer that day can go home have a beer and play video games.
And that's exactly what happened in this interview, which, you know, you've been on book tours. You know how it goes. You get this sheet that tells you these are the interviews you're doing today.
Yeah.
And what the hell do you know? You know, it's like, first of all, there's an unlimited, I mean, really an infinite number of radio shows.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's now an infinite number of podcasts.
And an infinite number of podcasts.
So this is...
So you wake up in the morning and it's like, these are the 12 interviews you are doing today. And you don't know.
So fast forward to this Fox News thing real quick.
Yeah, so one of them says Fox News. And I thought, all right, so, you know, just the next one on the list. And I... you know, and she, and again, it's that narrative thing that you were saying.
Yeah.
So the first thing that she says is, you know, you're a Muslim, so why did you write about Jesus? And I thought, wait, I get it. I get what's happening here. So I was like, well, let me just be clear that, yeah, I'm a Muslim. And I happen to be a Muslim, but this is what I do for a living. Like, I'm an expert on religion. I write about religion. And she says, oh, okay, all right. But again, that begs the question, why would you write about Jesus if you're a Muslim? And it's that O'Reilly thing started happening again, where I was like, oh, maybe she just didn't hear the first time, so I'll just say it again, because it's what I do for a living. Like, this is, I write about religion and religious people. I just happen to be Muslim. And then it just kept going. And it really, honestly, I've only seen it once.
It's pretty great.
It's excruciating.
It's excruciating, not from your part, but from hers. But I remember watching it. It's funny you say that, because I remember seeing it on social media in 2011, and I was like, holy shit, did that just happen? And then I watched it again, and I was like, uh-huh, that just happened.
You know what? The thing is that this was July, and nothing ever happens in July, you know, at least back then. Before, you know, we were in this existential crisis.
Now everything happens in July. Yeah.
And this story just kind of hit at the perfect time, but it became this gigantic global news story where, you know, I mean, I was getting emails from Somalia. You know, I was getting emails from like Congo.
Nigeria asking you for $1 million.
Asking for $1 million and also saying, that was such an excruciating interview.
Yeah.
Now I have some money that I would like to give
to
you.
I just need
your bank account. And it was kind of crazy. And yes, it obviously catapulted me to, you know, some other level. But what was really funny to me was how it became this interesting Rorschach test for America back then, you know.
In what way?
Well, in the sense that suddenly there was this dividing line over whether you were with Reza Aslan or against Reza Aslan. And it stopped being about me, like, by day three. By day three, it was no longer about me or the book. By day three, it was about America and journalism and, you know, religion and all of this stuff. And, you know, look, as an academic, you know, you sit back and you think to yourself, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. Like, this is the kind of conversations that I want to engender. And here it's happening, you know, at my expense, obviously, but it was still, you know, a fascinating experience, no question.
So do you think that back then there was already, and we're going to get to your book, I promise you, your new book, but I'm just curious, do you think that back then there was already the divide that exists today between viewpoints, especially, you know, around these topics, or was it the beginning of it?
No, I mean, there's no question that there was deep, serious divides back then, you know, and we're talking about, I guess, I don't know, what are we talking about? 2013, maybe? Yeah, so 2013, I think. You know, we were as divided as we had been in a very, very long time back then. But
we're more divided now.
Yeah, the divisions back then were about culture and politics. And religion, right? I mean, those were the primary divisions. Like, the problems that you had with the other side had to do with policy. It had to do with their interpretation of culture, their idea of America, etc. It didn't have to do with reality, right?
Mm.
Like, in other words, this idea that we're having a conversation about,
you know, whether Nazis and pedophiles are cool or not. Like, is that okay? Like, you know.
They're totally cool.
Yeah, it's like I thought
according
we had,
to the president.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, I thought, like, we had all agreed that Nazis and pedophiles bad.
Yeah.
And that was it. It doesn't matter whether you were right or left. And we don't have policy conversations anymore.
Do you think that part of that is a result of, I mean, I've been thinking about this quite a bit and over the past year and kind of scratching my head at how this divide became so binary. Before, I felt like there were topics and issues that were binary, but there were a lot that were not, and that there was a lot of gray in between. And I think when, you know, having covered tech companies and social media for over a decade now, and I think a lot of, you know, when you're trying to have a conversation in social media, and we're going to get to that topic with you in a little bit, but it's either you're like, I love Nazis or I hate Nazis. It's not like, hey, I knew this guy once and he had a really bad accident and hurt his head and he kind of was into Nazis, but now he's not. It's like, you know, there's no nuance whatsoever. Yeah. And I wonder if, you know, you look at the number of people that are on these platforms, if part of this is a result of that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's no question that most of our social media outlets are naturally geared towards this kind of bifurcation, right? This sort of, you know, which side are you on?
And there's only two sides.
And there's only two sides, yeah. I mean, that's for sure. And that's only heightened the political divides in the United States. But I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I'm nostalgic for the days of the political divide. You know, I'm nostalgic of the days when my problems with the other side had to do with their policies. This is a conversation I have all the time with people who are like, you know, Trump is terrible, but man, Pence is worse. And yeah, Pence is a terrible person. There's no question about that. Number one, I'm not afraid that he's going to accidentally kill us all. So that right there is a positive.
Unless you're gay.
Unless you're gay.
Then sorry.
Then you know. That's just how it goes. But I do think that, you know, there's something to be said about the days in which you could look to the other side and say, I have a problem with the policies that you are trying to implement, and let's have an argument about those policies, even if we may not meet in the middle.
Yeah.
Now, the other side is, you know, is led by a narcissistic sociopath. So it's like there is no meeting in the middle, because this, one side isn't playing in this game at all.
One side is not based in reality.
Right.
So speaking of that, you have a new book out called God.
God.
Did you get permission from God to use that title?
Well, it's actually a memoir, I should mention.
Oh, got it. How has all of the things that we're seeing happen with pretty much everything, these divides that we're talking about right now, how have they affected religion? Because the reason I ask that is I grew up in England, in the north of England, and 40 years ago, and I remember as a kid coming of age during all of the IRA bombings, and I was taught very early on that there were people who believed so strongly in different gods, essentially, in different religions, that they were willing to kill innocent people and each other as a result of that. And I remember being in, you know, our school sometimes, and, you know, school would be shut down, or I was once in Manchester at the mall, and there were tanks that came in, and they cleared everything out, and something, that, you know, and there were explosions and so on and so forth. And I remember being so perplexed that was so important to people. Yeah. Has technology made it worse, or has it made it better?
It's made it worse, but let me go back a little bit, because I think the important thing, and the most important thing to understand about religion, is that regardless of what religion you're talking about, regardless of where in the world you're talking about, religion is first and foremost a matter of identity. It's far more a matter of identity than it is a matter of beliefs and practices. Beliefs and practices are important. I'm not saying that those things don't matter. But I think a lot of people, particularly non-religious people, simply assume that a religious person is someone who just believes the things that their religion tells them to. When in reality, religious people are all over the place when it comes to how much of the doctrines of their particular religion they actually accept and how much they do not. But what is important is that when someone says that they're a Jew or a Protestant or a Catholic or a Muslim or whatever, they are making an identity statement. And it's a statement that has as much to do with who they are in the world, how they understand themselves, how they recognize their connection to other people. It has more to do with that than it does to do with these are the things, these are the religious doctrines that I accept, and these are the rituals that I take part in. And so if it's true that religion is first and foremost a matter of identity, then that means it's wrapped up in all the other markers of your identity. And that includes your politics, it includes your gender, your sexual orientation, your economic views, your ethnicity, your race. It's impossible to extricate religion from those other things. These are all different markers of your identity, and when they wrap themselves together, they make who you are as a person. And so, as a result, you know, religion becomes both a cohesive force and a divisive force. It's about in-groups and out-groups. And sometimes the in-groups, out-groups are by different religions. You're a Jew, I'm a Muslim. Sometimes they're within sects. You're a Catholic, I'm a Protestant. Sometimes they're just based on a certain kind of doctrine. Well, you're an Irish Catholic and I am, you know, an American Catholic. And I think if you first of all begin with that sort of postulate, then everything else makes sense. Then everything else that religion does in the world, good and bad, all the ways in which religion is expressed, all the conflicts of religion that we all see, all of it suddenly makes sense because it's just people fighting over their very sense of self, their identity. And what technology has done, as you know better than anyone, is that it's allowed us to, in many ways, reframe what our collective identities actually are. Right? This is it's an old sociological issue, right? That from the dawn of time to about, I don't know, two decades ago, the definition of community was the people around you.
Yeah.
You know, it was a geographic definition.
Completely. Maps were based on locations, not
that's
people.
Right. And whether that's your cave or your village or your city or your nation, the point is community meant geography. And what technology and social media especially has done is it has shattered that community no longer has any kind of geographic boundaries. You may have more in common with some kid in Indonesia because you like the same music than either of you have in common with anyone in your neighborhood or city or state. And what that has done is that, yes, it's changed the way that we create our collectives, but it hasn't made those collectives any less polarizing or any less divisive. It's just expanded it in some way. So, and it's done that with religion, certainly. You know, you can create an entire virtual religious community now based solely on, you know, your hatred of gay people, for instance, or your, you know, views on a particular you know, verse in your scripture. So it's created micro communities, but they're just as much divisive as they were before.
Are we better off or worse off?
I'm not smart enough to answer that question. I don't know.
We should ask your gardeners.
We should ask the blower out there.
The blower out there.
I mean, we just are, aren't we? Like, it's such a hard question to ask.
No, yeah. It's really interesting because, you know, the promise of technology was always that it would connect us, which I think is actually it has done, and that it would give us information that would set us free in many respects, which I don't think it has done.
No.
I think it's kind of imprisoned us more and more. But you know, you look in the App Store, the number one downloaded app in history is the Bible. You know, it's like If you look at, you know, on Kindle, the number one commented book is the Bible. It's like, you know, it's mm-hmm. it is doing something to religion, but it doesn't seem necessarily that at the end of the day, it's making the whole conversation any better.
I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I was one of those people. It's so funny that, you know, we grew up at a time before there was the internet. And before, there wasn't email when I was in college. And before there was, you know, social media, and then there was. And so I remember very clearly, as I'm sure you do too, being very excited about that promise and thinking to myself, not only are we now finally getting mm-hmm. rid of the gatekeepers of information, right? So that anyone can access information, you know, themselves. That's a huge thing. But that it's going to create precisely these infinite levels of connection. But I think what we all forgot about is human nature. And human nature is such that we are tribal people. Mm-hmm. We look to other individuals who look or feel or act or think like we do, and we create our communities in that way. And what, you know, social media has essentially done is it's accelerated that process. So even with, especially with regard to religion, it's created these micro communities. It's fractured religion even more. Hmm. Like, it'd be one thing to say, well, I'm a non-denominational evangelical Christian who lives in Pittsburgh. And so essentially, you know, there are people around me who more or less believe what I believe, you know, insofar as my theology and all that stuff, but some of them don't share certain other views. The idea that I could go online and find people who think exactly the way that I do, who read the Bible exactly the way that I do.
Well, it's
and
it's,
who are everywhere.
And I mean, what you're summing up is also the people that go to Fox News and Breitbart and the New York Times, and it is something that has fractured everything.
Yeah. This is Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
I have a kind of love-hate relationship with the holidays. I love that I'll get to spend time with my family and friends, but I also get bummed out that there are people all over the country I won't get to see and spend time with. This year, I've decided that rather than send those folks in other parts of the country cards and presents, I'm going to send them bouquets of flowers, and I'm going to do so using proflowers.com. After all, a bouquet of festive plants or flowers from ProFlowers is perfect because it's not the same traditional old gift or card. In fact, it says so much more. If you want to do the same thing, listeners of the Inside the Hive podcast get 20% off any ProFlowers bouquet or plant of $29 or more. All you need to do is go to proflowers.com and use the code HIVE, that's H-I-V-E, at checkout. There's lots of festive options to choose from, including their best-selling candy cane roses, which, no, you cannot eat, they're not edible. And you can't go wrong with their classic mini Christmas tree that comes with lights and ornaments. It's perfect for a kitchen, a cubicle, or someone's fancy corner office. So again, listeners of Inside the Hive get 20% off any ProFlowers bouquet or plants of $29 or more. All you need to do is go to proflowers.com and use the code HIVE at checkout. Once again, proflowers.com, the code is HIVE. All right, so let me ask you a question. How many books have you written on religion now?
This is, I guess, I read four books on religion and one on literature.
So do you believe that, and I've asked you this before, but I'm going to ask you again, and I know it's probably a dumb, loaded question, but do you believe that there is some sort of higher power up there?
Yeah. I mean, if you're saying, do I believe in God? The answer is yes. I think that that question, though, is not very interesting. A much more interesting, much
there
more...
There are no silly questions, rather.
Just silly people. they're the far more significant question, and the question that I'm trying to get people to ask is not, do you believe in God or not, but what do you mean by God? And it's so funny that this word God, which is probably the most variable word in the English language, is also the word that everyone just assumes, you know, is universal in a way, that we all mean the same thing when we say God, and we don't. And so it makes it very difficult for either people who do or who do not believe in God to just simply state, yeah, I don't believe in God, or yes, I do believe in God, because we have no idea what the listener it thinks of when they think of God.
But aren't they thinking of some sort of higher power up there or down there or around there or whatever? I mean, isn't that the thought process when you ask that question?
For a lot of people. I think for the vast majority of people, and this is precisely what the book is about, what they mean by God is a divine version of themselves. And this is sort of what's really fascinating about this process, that when you dig into the psychological and cognitive processes through which the very idea of God arose, what you see is that we human beings have this innate compulsion to bestow upon God our own personality, our own emotions, our own virtues and vices and strengths and weaknesses, that essentially what we do when we think about God, and this is whether we believe in God or not, is we create a divine version of ourselves, a superhuman being with human emotions and motivations, but without human limitations.
And God is not that.
My God is not that.
How do you know?
I don't know. I don't know.
What? How do you get to this point where you believe that something exists, but the thing that exists is different to each person?
Right.
I mean, what's the pathway that gets you there?
It's actually not that complicated. I mean, I call it sort of the three questions, right? Question number one, do you believe that something exists beyond the material realm, something real, something palpable, something knowable? Or do you believe that the material realm, what we experience with our empirical senses, is the only reality, that there is no other reality? It's a simple choice. There's no proof either way. It's an experiential question more than anything else. That's Hugo. Just leave him. He's going to just blow behind me. He's fine.
Hugo the blower is back.
Hugo the blower. And Hugo believes that there's something beyond the material realm.
Yes.
Do you believe that there's something beyond the material realm or not? Is this the only reality, or is there some other reality? That's it. Don't define the other reality. That's it. Just do you believe that there's something else? That's not a rational question. It's an experiential question. It's about the experiences that you have had that make you think that there is more than this. Question number one, yes or no? Simple, it's just a choice. If the answer is no, you're a materialist, good for you. There's nothing wrong with that. Go about your life and enjoy it. If the answer is yes, then that brings the second question up, which is, does that matter? Do you care? Do you want to know that thing? Do you want to actually experience that thing? However it's defined, however you envision it, do you want to feel it, to experience it
and
or
is
not?
That, and that's church? That's the Bible? That's,
no, we're no. not even we're not even anywhere near religion yet. These
Got
are
it.
Just questions of emotion and nothing more. And the answer to that, again, is either yes or no. If no, okay, well then you're an agnostic and good for you, and that's really the only intellectually honest answer to this question anyway. So, enjoy your life. But if the answer is yes, that number one, yes, I do think there is something more, and number two, I do want to feel it. I do want to experience it. I want to know it in some way. Then that's where the third part comes in, which is, how do you want to experience it? Now, it does help, though it's by no means necessary, to have a language with which to express what is fundamentally an inexpressible experience. And that's what religion does. Religion is just a ready-made set of symbols and metaphors that provides a language to an individual and to a community to communicate to each other and to themselves this ineffable experience that I'm talking about, the experience of transcendence, of faith, or however you want to say it. And any one of those languages is fine. It's just those languages are nothing more than a means of expressing this thing. You don't need one of those languages. You can experience that same sense of transcendence through nature. You can experience it through your family. You can experience it through, you know, the love that you have for your children or for your wife. You can experience it through a whole host of different things. But that's pretty much it. That's it. It's just about answering those three questions.
So once you, I mean, so putting those questions aside for a second, do you, in your research, believe that there is a, given that you believe that there is a God, that there is a reason that we are here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fundamentally what saying there is a God means.
But so what is the reason?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think what I would say is, go ahead.
I've gone through this a lot, and I'm sure everyone listening has, and it's a conversation I have with people all the time. And you know, if there's a reason, and you know, are we doing the right thing, and so on and so forth, and it's people like, it is honestly, you know, people like Donald Trump who make me question if there is, because I don't understand how there's a purpose behind someone like that. I think put aside your politics, him as a human being. Forget that. Let's just forget he's even president, right?
Yeah.
That there can be someone who is so intent, or even Hitler, or Charles Manson, or whatever it is that is so intent upon appeasing themselves and causing harm to so many people and such narcissism and selfishness, it just doesn't make sense to me that there's a reason for that.
And I get that, and I think that a lot of people would probably agree with that sentiment. I think my conception of the divine is far more expansive than just this, you know, idea of why are there bad things in the world, or why are there bad people in the world. And when I say reason and purpose, I by no means mean it in the prosaic sense of you know, the reason is for us to be good, or the purpose is for us to be positive. I mean, I think for me, the reason and purpose is a much more, you know, it's metaphysical and it's an emotional. You know, if I were to put it into words, I would say it's so that we can know each other, and that we can know ourselves in the sense of that the experience of being alive is about more than just the random, you know, occurrences of material matter. You know, the idea that you know, what reality is nothing more than you know, a chaos of atoms. That there is an underlying will behind it. And if we use the words purpose or reason, I suppose, in the same way, but again, what that starts to make us do is precisely what I'm trying to get people to not do,
which is
to humanize the divine, to assume.
So your theory is that there is some reason, there is some purpose, but it is beyond the comprehension of us mere little humans.
I mean, I wouldn't put it necessarily in those terms, in the sense that, you know, God's ways are not like our ways. I mean, those are sort of, you know, trite religious sayings that don't have much meaning to me. What I would say is this, is that what we know is, and this is based on both archaeological and cognitive evidence, what we know is that the religious impulse, however you want to define it, let's define it in the way that I was defining it earlier, in this idea of the belief that there is something beyond, that is a universal impulse, that it exists in all people, in all cultures, in every place in the world, and throughout all of time. That in fact, you know, as the archaeological evidence indicates, that predates Homo sapiens. That is an impulse that existed in previous species of humans. It existed in Neanderthals. It existed in Homo erectus. And the issue that I think a lot of scholars grapple with, and a lot of evolutionary theorists and cognitive scientists, is why? So the question isn't, does this exist? There is unanimity. It's a nobody questions that this is an impulse that exists in all people. In fact, the evidence now indicates that it's an impulse that we're born with. You know, there's been numerous studies by cognitive scientists and psychologists that show that children are born with an innate sense of substance dualism, by which we mean an understanding that the body and mind are separate and distinct. You can replace the word mind with soul if you want to, or with psyche, or whatever. You can replace it with whatever you want to.
But we are born understanding that they are two distinct things.
We are born with that belief, which means that it's a cognitive impulse. It exists in our brain somehow. So that's not up for debate. What is up for debate is why. And as I outline, you know, clearly in the book, there's been 200 years of trying to answer that question. You know, why? Why do we have this impulse? Was there some adaptive advantage to it? Did it help us, you know, in our ancient past to survive in some way? Is it part of our human evolution or not? And just to skip to the end of that process, the overwhelming consensus now is that it doesn't, that there is no reason for it to exist, that it has no adaptive advantage at all. There's no evolutionary reason for this religious impulse.
I could think of reasons.
Go for it.
You know, I love the look that you're giving me now.
I'm telling you.
I am going to be afraid to die because I'm afraid of what could lie on the other side. That this could be just what?
That's right. So fear of death, absolutely. Fear of
death. Isn't that evolutionary? Isn't that?
No, but it's not an adaptive advantage. There's no adaptive advantage in prehistoric human beings between an individual who isn't afraid to die and an individual who is. On the contrary, it's a disadvantage in many ways. Just to go through the list. I mean, look, the list, we all know the list because we all have our ideas about it, right? Mm-hmm. So people will say, based on a little bit of what you were saying right there, they'll say, well, okay, but what about, you know, the fact that religion provides, you know, answers to unanswerable questions? True, it does. Again, no reason at all to think that that's an adaptive advantage, that somehow helps our species survive.
Well, I mean, here's another thing. I mean, maybe adaptive advantage is too strong a term for this, but, you know, I have a friend who's from South America, and her family is, you know, with like every family, there's problems. There's a son who has issues and an aunt who does this and that and so on and so forth. And for them, for the family, the Bible and the church and God, life is too difficult. It's too overwhelming to try to comprehend and get their head around. And there is this thing that exists to help them kind of ferry their way through it. And without it, they would spin out of control, and probably, you know, that would be the end of it.
Well, so you're bringing up three issues about religion. Number one, that it provides some kind of moral guidance, first and foremost. So usually, you know, through some kind of absolute moral, you know, divine lawgiver. Again, true, except that the very concept of a divine lawgiver is barely 5,000 years old, and the notion of religion as a form of morality is even newer than that. Forget about going back hundreds of thousands of years ago. Even go back to the Mesopotamians, or the Egyptians, or the Greeks, or the Iranians. Their pantheons of gods were not in any shape or form symbols of human morality.
No, they were symbols of fear. They were symbols of hope.
Yes, but first of all, they were not symbols of hope or fear. What they did was implant either hope or fear, and they did so equally. You know, and this is the second thing that you were talking about, is that it makes you feel better, or as Freud put it, it takes away anxiety in some way. And so that could possibly be an adaptive advantage. That's actually a good argument that, look, you know, there are health risks to being anxious, so maybe that's the idea. Except that religion actually increases anxiety. It doesn't decrease anxiety. I mean, if you think that the entire universe is predicated on whether you make this sacrifice on time or not, that's an anxious building. It's an anxiety building
mechanism.
Unless
you actually make the sacrifice on time, and then you're like, finally.
The most common reason that people give for why religion exists is because of social cohesion, right? As we were talking about before, that it creates... a social bond among quote-unquote believing communities that would give them an advantage over unbelieving communities. But again, not only is that suspect view, but for that view to hold, religion would have to have some uniquely adaptive social cohesion advantage, and it doesn't. Kinship is how our ancient communities collected around each other. What you are bringing up, and this is a very important point, what you are bringing up is a functionalist argument. You are saying what religion does, which is true, but that is not an explanation for why religion exists. And it's certainly not an explanation for why religion is a cognitive impulse, why it exists in our brains. And so, the dividing line on this question right now is between those evolutionary theorists who say that the only explanation for the existence of the religious impulse is that it's an accident, that it's some byproduct of some other evolutionary adaptive advantage, something else in our brain that we needed in order to survive, developed, and as a process of that development, religion and the religious impulse became this echo that we all have, that we're all born with, despite the fact that there is no evidence that it itself is an adaptive advantage. And again, the issues are kind of complicated, but it's essentially two cognitive processes, one of which is called hyperactive agency detection device, and that's that thing.
Now you're just showing off.
Yeah, now I'm sure. That's that thing that
we all
have.
Do you
want to
put the Wikipedia page away for a minute here?
HADD is this thing that we all have that compels us to... the way that I put it is that it's the reason why we think every bump in the night is caused by someone doing the bumping, right? It forces us to give agency to natural phenomena. And that's definitely an adaptive advantage.
Now my dog is here. Let me let my dog.
Yeah.
You can keep talking for a
second. The other thing, the second cognitive development is called the theory of mind. And the theory of mind is this other thing that we all have, that we're all born with. And it's that thing that makes us recognize that someone who looks like us must also feel like us. It actually, I think, turns on in a child's brain like around 6 months old or something like that.
Yeah, there's been a lot of research around this lately that's been talking exactly about this topic. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what a lot of cognitive theorists now believe is that if you combine hyperactive agency detection device and theory of mind, both of which are evolutionary processes that gave us an adaptive advantage as we were, you know, deep in our prehistoric past, that somehow when those two things touch each other, the religious impulse arises just as an accidental byproduct. That, by the way, is a very good theory. It's a theory, but it's a good one. An equally good theory is where we began this conversation, which is it's just how we're made. That there is a reason for it, that it's who we are, that it's a mode of knowing that we are meant to have.
So I know you have to go pick up your kids in your minivan in a little bit.
thanks but, for outing me
yeah,
with the
sorry.
Minivan.
In your Porsche 911. But I have a few more questions.
Sure.
So do you go to bed at night and put your kids down and kiss your wife and lay there and think, am I doing the right thing here in this game that I'm, you know, that we're all on? Or do you, I mean, is it something that as someone who spends most of your waking hours thinking about religion and purpose and so on and so forth, something that occupies your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I do think about it a lot. I feel good about where I am right now. I can't say that was true for a lot of my life. I find my deepest spiritual connections, the place where I feel closest to God, however that wants to be defined. And I should emphasize that I do, at the end of the book, basically just lay out what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And what I believe is what our ancient ancestors believed. You know, I'm a pantheist. I believe that there is no difference between creation and creator, that God is the universe. That means all of us are God, all things are God. And nowhere do I experience that reality more clearly than when I'm with my family, than mm-hmm. when I am tucking yeah. my kids in, than when I am lying down next to my wife and sort of thinking about, you know, the world and what I've done and whether I feel good about it or not. And more than anything, you know, this book is not supposed to be just kind of an interesting history of the way that humans have thought about God, you know, since the very moment in which the idea first arose. It's also meant to be an argument. It's also meant to be, you know, a kind of a sort of, you know, an argument for a new way of thinking about God, to stop humanizing the divine, whether you believe in God or not. Stop thinking of God as someone who looks and acts and feels and thinks like us, and start thinking about God the way that our prehistoric ancestors thought about God, as the animating force of the universe. And I think when you think that way, not only will it lead to, I think, a deeper, more meaningful spirituality, but I think that it leads to a better world. I mean, if I see you and I know that you are God, then I can't delegitimize you. I can't denigrate your humanity because you're God. I can't exploit or abuse nature or the world because nature and the world is God. If you react to everything around you as though it is divine because it is divine, then it transforms the way you think. So no, I don't sit around, you know, praying to God as though God's some guy who's listening to me and answering my prayers. I don't, you know, that's not how my spirituality works. My spirituality is fully integrated into the very way in which I understand and react to the universe, because the universe is God.
All right. So last couple of questions. I'm going to move away from the book for 10 seconds here and talk about your little CNN fiasco, because we have to end on a light note here.
Yeah.
Earlier this summer, mm-hmm. Donald Trump had done something. What was it that he had done?
This was during the terror attack on the Thames, where somebody drove over a bunch of people and they fell into the water.
And
in the first few minutes while that was happening, while we were fishing dead bodies out of the water, like that's where we're talking about when this happened, Donald Trump thought that would be a good time for the president of the United States to tweet, "I told you so," and to say that this is why we need a Muslim ban in America. And I responded that he's a piece of shit.
So just to set this up, you at the time had a show on CNN called Believer.
Yeah, the first season had already premiered. It was a massive hit for CNN. It was the biggest premiere of any original show that
they've ever
had.
So what happened? Yeah. So I saw that what happened in the media, what happened behind the scenes? You tweeted this. Did you immediately think like, that wasn't such a great idea?
Nope.
Or were you immediately
not even
like,
a little bit?
Okay, so what happened?
I put my phone down and took my family to dinner. And by the way, that was maybe the fifth time that I had called Donald Trump a piece of shit on Twitter. It's just that this time, the right-wing media, the Daily Caller and Breitbart and you know, that whole collective decided that they were going to use it as a way to punish CNN.
So you go to dinner, you come home and
go to sleep.
You don't even check your phone that night.
Nope.
You go to sleep.
And I wake up in the morning.
Yeah.
And I've got like emergency emails from CNN, from my agents, from everyone. And you know, we had a conversation and
When you get those emails, were you like, were you a little nervous or were you just like, okay, well, let's see where this goes?
Well, the funny story is that when I got those emails, I wrote a very long reply, basically, you know, not apologizing, you know, I wrote this very long statement about, the fact that the president of the United States is a racist, sexist, lying, lecherous, pathological liar and narcissistic sociopath, that we are in an existential crisis, that our lives are in danger, and that anyone who has a voice needs to be screaming at the top of their lungs because all of history is watching us right now. And I was basically told, publish this statement and the show is done. And I was like, okay. And
so you're home at this point?
Yeah, it's Sunday. I tweeted on Saturday. Now it's Sunday.
And so what's your wife saying? What's Jessica saying? Or like
Jessica,
what?
You know, Jessica, you know, she's nervous. She's, you know, she's freaking out.
And what are the Breitbart articles saying? Are they like not very nice? Are they?
The Breitbart articles were interestingly, explicitly Islamophobic, right?
Got it.
So the hashtag that they started using was CNN is ISIS. Hmm. Which, you know, again, this is
good,
nothing
good
to
branding.
Do with, exactly. This has nothing to do with Islam. It's just I happen to be a Muslim who said this thing. And so, you know, I deleted the statement and I changed and I wrote a statement basically saying, you know, this is why I said what I said. I shouldn't have said it and I apologize. And then CNN issued a statement 5 minutes later saying they accepted my apology. I'm not really a CNN employee anyway.
And you posted your statement on Twitter?
I posted my statement on Twitter, and then they posted their statement on Twitter as well as a response. And as far as they're concerned, the issue is over. And then Monday came around, and we were back in production. So we were deep in production on season two. I should mention that.
Got it.
Like we were, you know, we'd...
Who is this coming from at CNN? Is this Zucker all the way at the top? Like who?
No, this is... I don't want to name names, but it's essentially the people who run the original series department.
Got it.
At CNN.
But it's probably coming.
It's coming
definitely
from Zucker. Yeah, absolutely.
It.
And, you know, Monday rolled around and we're back in production. And by Tuesday, the story was over. You know, there was still, it never really became, you know, a big mainstream story. I think the only mainstream news outlet to pick it up was the Boston Globe. Otherwise, it was all right-wing news groups. And this was after the O'Reilly boycott movement and the Hannity boycott movement. So it was
their turn.
Yeah, it was their turn. They were using it. And they were doing the same thing with Maddow to fire Maddow and fire Aslan became this kind of, you know, hashtag. And by the way, it was amazing how all the articles were essentially the same. It was the exact same article just cut and paste into different you know, right-wing news outlets. And then, and you know, it was over and we moved on. And then on Thursday, out of the blue, you know, we're packing up to get on a plane to fly to London to shoot an episode. And out of the blue, Zucker just dropped the show.
Did he call you? Did like...
Nope. He told... He was having lunch with Lloyd Braun, who's the head of the production company that I work... that we did the show with. And he just turned to Lloyd and said, "I'm dropping your boy," and it blew everyone's mind. Like it took everyone by surprise. It took everyone at CNN by surprise.
Where were you when you heard this?
I was in a production meeting with the director, and like packing my clothes to get on a flight the next day, basically.
And so the news hits the Zucker has dropped the show.
Yep.
And then it just kind of exploded again.
Well, and then, and he said that he was going to make an announcement on Friday that they're dropping the show. And what he said was, you know, very clearly, and by the way, I've never told this story before. And what he said very clearly was, be cool and you'll get the show back.
Zucker said this to you?
No.
Oh, Lloyd said this to you.
Yes, it came down the very long ladder down to me eventually, which was no hard feelings, but we have to drop the show. And he didn't give a reason, though I think we now know what the reason was. I mean, this was when, you know, the first stirrings of the AT&T Time Warner merger was coming out into the open. And even back then, Trump was illegally talking about how the only way he's going to let this thing happen is if they get rid of either Zucker or CNN, you know, punish CNN in some way. And I think Zucker, despite the fact that the show was a huge money-making success for them, decided it's not worth it, and I'll just throw the Trump administration a bone. And he cut the show. Surprising everybody.
So this is Thursday. So the language that comes to you is like, just chill and you'll get it back in a little while.
It was made perfectly clear to me. I don't need to say by whom how.
Yeah.
But what I can say is that it was made perfectly clear to me that this is going to be amicable, that, you know, just let's be nice and let's be friendly. And when this whole thing dies down, you can have the show back. You can have the season back. You can get paid all the money that we owe you, and we'll all just end as friends. And then the announcement came on Friday, and it became this gigantic story for the weekend. I mean, CNN was clobbered for their decision, and they should have been. It was a ridiculous decision.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks pass. And, you know, then we reached out to CNN and said, okay, so, you know, we'll give us the show back and let's move on. And they basically told us to go fuck ourselves.
They didn't use that language, right?
The offer that they made was the legal version of go fuck yourself. It was, you can't have the show.
Yeah.
You can't have the format.
Yeah.
We own Reza Aslan Goes Around the World Exploring Religion, so you can never do that again. We own the title. We're not going to pay you a penny that we contractually are obligated to pay you.
Wow.
We're not even going to pay you back the money that you spent. And it was, I mean, we were blown away. Like, we couldn't believe it. Like, it was such a shock to hear that. Now, let me just say that after months and months of wrangling and going back and forth and having the lawyers battle it out and us telling to them, this is not a real, you know, opening offer. This is, you know, a joke, and we are taking this as an insult, just so you know. And them responding, you know, and it went back and forth for a long time. Last week, it finally settled, and now we have everything back. We've got the show back. We've got the
title
back. It's ours again. No, they will never show it again. So it's ours again. So now we can go and put it up on another platform and tell it. But I want to say what's important and what is still sort of so dumbfounding to me. I'm not dumbfounded that, you know, Zucker did something shitty. Okay, I'm not.
Yeah.
I mean, I think anybody who's worked with Zucker knows that.
Yeah.
That happens. What I'm dumbfounded by is the bizarre punitive measures that they put. So not only did they cancel the second season, not only did they make this, you know, ludicrous offer of not giving us anything or paying us the money that they owe us,
which is just, it's pennies to them.
It's pennies to them, yeah. They stripped their site clean of the show. So the CNN app is an archive of every show that they've ever done, ever, except for Believer. And they removed Believer from their site on the first day of Emmy voting. They essentially embargoed it so that even though they'd already premiered the show, all the episodes, even though they've already done reruns of it, they made sure that no one could watch this thing again.
All because of a little three words in a tweet.
I think... So the this is how it was kind of explained to me by somebody in the know, is that, you know, when you do something to the mafia, they don't just kill you, they kill your whole family. And Zucker is in an uncomfortable position. I get it. He's got a news organization, and he has decided to do original programming with people who are not employees of CNN. We don't work for CNN. Bourdain and Kamau Bell and Lisa Ling and Bill Ware and Morgan Spurlock, me, we don't work for CNN. They bought our show. They distribute yeah. our show.
Yeah.
We are not journalists, with the exception of Lisa. We're not journalists. And so we don't abide by journalism rules. And I think this has always been a bit of a problem for Zucker. And I think what he did was he used me as a way to send a message to everyone else. And that message to Lisa and Bill and Morgan and Kamau, I mean, not Tony Bourdain, he can do whatever the hell he wants to. But the message to everyone else was, be careful what you say.
Don't talk politics.
Don't talk politics. Just stay in your lane and don't make a big deal about it. Otherwise, I'm going to whack you and your family like I did with Reza.
So did you ever send the original tweet of the statement? The statement that you were originally...
No.
Do you have it still?
Maybe.
You should tweet it.
I should probably, yeah. It's long.
You should tweet it with a link to this podcast.
Let me see if I can find it somewhere.
All right, sounds good. Well, Reza Aslan, thank you so much for taking the time. His new book is God, A Human History, and he is the number one New York Times bestselling author of Zealot. He also drives a minivan and has a group of gardeners that follow him around everywhere.
And you're going to see Believer on a streaming site very soon.
Just don't tweet that the president is a piece of shit unless you've okayed it with the CEO of that streaming site first.
By the way, I am convinced that if I had called him a piece of shit like 2 weeks ago as opposed to 4 months ago, no one would have noticed. Because at this point...
Oh, yeah, everyone. It's like a trending topic.
Yeah.
The president is a piece of shit.
The president is literally a piece of shit.
It's a trending topic out there.
And now it's just, you know what I mean? But whatever.
On that note, I'm going to go pray to God that this president does not win a second term. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nick. Take care.
Thanks to my guest today, Reza Aslan. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a really nice, glowing, happy, fun review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, my editors at Vanity Fair, and thanks, of course, to my sponsor, ProFlowers. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I will see you all next week.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts. From PR.